like anything else that we
Hello?
Hello.
Hello, Greg?
Sorry, I have fun with those things. When they, is this a conference? It's just the two of us, right?
Yep, it's just you and me.
Yeah, well, generally when it's a conference call, when they ask for your name, I just do something crazy like that, and everybody's wondering who the hell it is.
Yeah, I said, I wonder if that's the wrong person.
It worked, see?
Yeah. Okay, we are recording. Thank the Lord. Happy Easter, first of all.
Thanks.
So you're the chairman of the Bread Bakers Guild. Tell me a little bit about how you started baking.
I started baking, well, I guess I started baking in culinary school.
Uh-huh.
I went to, I've always cooked and I baked somewhat at home, probably cookies or things like that. But not breads at home. And I worked in restaurants and I worked often with the breakfast people, and you know, I would help them do some baking, but I didn't really start baking until I went to culinary school, and I lived by the Rockridge BART station. And so when I got off the train one of my first weeks of school, I walked past Grace Baking's window, and they were, you know, school was got out at night, so I was walking past there, I guess, around 9:30 or 10 at night, and just so happened one of my friends from high school was working in there, and I needed a job, so I started working at Grace after you know, I would go to school and then go to Grace and then go home and sleep.
Oh, okay. And tell us a little bit about your bakery.
My bakery is in the town of Sonoma, and it's going to be 15 years old in July. And we are, I guess you could say that we're kind of a full-line bakery. We do, but really in the bread world, a full-line. We don't make too much in the pastry world, but we do a lot of Danish and croissant and cookies and scones and muffins and things like that, but we also do a whole line of hearth-style breads, European-style breads.
I recently heard that you had merged with Boudin Bakery in San Francisco. Is that right?
Well, not, I don't know if merged is the right word. My family helped me start the bakery 15 years ago, and my sister had been in the restaurant world a lot of her life, and but other than that, we were the only two that had ever been in the world of food. But my mother and my stepfather helped me financially and also physically in terms of helping with keeping the books and things like that for the first 10 or 11 years of the bakery. And my passion and interest is, still to this day is growing, and theirs was pretty burned out, and understandably, you know, because it wasn't their passion and world in the first place. So I, you know, I was looking for a escape, you know, a way to take care of them and for their efforts and for me to have the opportunity to keep growing and learning and doing new and different things. So the folks that own Boudin bought my family out of their business.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're my partners. We're not really merged. There's the concept of Boudin or my bakery artisan have no parallels whatsoever. I mean, I don't mean that. I shouldn't say it so strongly like that. But in terms of business or what we're up to or whatever, we're, you know, it's different management group and different bakers, different people. There's not a whole lot to do with each other.
Uh-huh.
We do help each other, and we're friends and that kind of stuff.
And what's your role as the chairman of the Bread Bakers Guild exactly?
Well, I guess my role is, that's a good question. What is my role? I think I'm a little bit of a figurehead, you know, somebody that has a little bit of a reputation as a baker, and that my leadership, I'm pretty fond of the mission of the guild, which is education. So I think I provide a strong, I'm a strong enforcer of the mission, is what my role is. Constantly pushing us to provide more educational material and more educational events at a higher quality and and continue to support the Bread Bakers Guild Team USA concepts and all that kind of stuff. So.
Mm-hmm. And as that role gets bigger, like bread does, it rises. Do you think the American bakery scene or field needs to do like an apprenticeship system like in France?
Well, it's a subject that's come and gone many times within. I've been involved in the Guild almost since the beginning. And I think the Guild started in something like 92 or 3 or something. I opened my bakery right around that same time, and I was first aware of the Guild in 94 and pretty much latched on to it immediately because I was in a major growing learning stage, and the having an organization that was trying to help teach somebody like myself was a perfect match. The problem with the apprenticeship idea in the United States is has a lot to do with the size of our country. You know, it's France is a much more manageable situation to have a nationwide program, and so and also the culture is you know, the American culture as far as the idea of apprenticeship is, you know, it doesn't exist a whole lot. It doesn't occur to a lot of people. I tend to say youth, but in our country, people start careers at all different ages. But where it's part of the culture in Europe, not just France, but all over, that's kind of a part of the process of getting to be where you want to be. So there's a lot of reasons why that hasn't happened today, and I don't know if it ever will happen. It certainly isn't a high focus for me. As far as the leader of the chairman is to get an apprenticeship program going, just because we're just too spread out, too big.
And bread, I guess, in the States is pretty much, say, like the melting pot sort of breads. And is there a quintessential bread that is you could call American?
Well, I would say the pan bread, the Pullman bread, whatever term you want to call it, I think that has a big American stamp on it because, well, it's part of the
industrialization.
Thank you very much of the bread process, and I think, you know, I'm not real clear on all of history of bread, but you know, I believe America really institutionalized the bread process and made it. Made it the big industrialization that it became, and it's not and that's not a knock on us, by the way. In fact, you know, I always kind of what that made me think of was Japan, because I've been lucky enough to travel over to Japan a few times, and in the bread world, that's why I was there. I was working, and they make the best Pullman bread you've ever seen. You know, a perfect. Perfect square loaf of bread. And my understanding is, you know, after World War II, we pretty much had, I mean, I've seen photos of what we did to that country, and it was flat, you know, the cities were flat. There was no infrastructure left. And then when you sign a peace treaty or whatever process that happens in war, the aftermath is that there are people to feed and take care of. And my understanding is that, you know, what we brought to their culture after, you know, flattening them out was this white bread, you know, Pullman bread, because that was something we knew how to do well and fast, and it's part of their culture. I mean, it's a fairly modern part of their culture, but it's very, very much available everywhere.
Yeah.
So I would say that would be my answer.
Since artisan baking has become, I guess, a label, and it's sort of a renaissance of, I don't know, I talked to Steve Sullivan recently, and we were kind of going, is it like retro hippie, like Noel Comes had said, called it, or is it just people want to go back to a certain type of bread, and will doing, you know, real hands-on stuff change the way the industry thinks about baking bread in America?
Well, it's been a really interesting revolution, and I listened to your interview with Steve. I thought that I think that, you know, and Steve was obviously, for me, the business of Acme was a huge influence on me. I mean, I remember eating his bread. My mother was she has a story of going to Chez Panisse within the first month that it had opened and became, you know, we still go to Chez Panisse. It's one of our very favorite restaurants. And so I've been eating Acme bread before I even knew it was Acme bread. And as soon as he opened his first location that had a retail aspect to it, my mother happened to work, you know, a few blocks from there. So we had Acme bread on my table, you know, almost every night. When I was a young, you know, I was just, you know, I lived in the Bay Area until I was about 22 or something. So his first 5 years of business, I was a frequent person. But before him, there was the Zen Center in Tassajara, and there was the kind of the sprouted hippie breads. And there's kind of this, you can kind of see this evolution to where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if the handcrafted aspect of it is what people are necessarily attracted to, and certainly in the Bay Area here and places like New York and Portland and, you know, some of these cities that have, you know, this culture of people that are interested in going and buying their meat at the, you know, at the butcher and going and getting their produce from the vegetable guy and then getting cheese from the cheese guy is, you know, a real fantastic, you know, kind of European-rooted, you know, way of doing life, and we're lucky enough to have that here in the Bay Area. But I don't know if that speaks to the general public of the United States, and this bread movement is not just in the United States. It's actually an enormous bread movement all over the world of getting back to kind of a real bread, not a bread that sits on a shelf necessarily for a few weeks, you know, a real food or... I'm not sure what the best term is, but, you know, something that's meant to be eaten that day and not sit around for a few weeks and have a bunch of chemicals in it. So my search when I'm out, I'm a frequenter of eating out. I'm not saying that's a good thing or not, but my most disappointing aspect of that is often the bread on the table. And so, you know, all I'm looking for is a good loaf of bread. I don't really feel strongly that it has to be made by hand, but that the science and the understanding of how to make good bread is within the capabilities of a bakery.
Eaten in many a restaurant, and you do find really horrible bread on your table, and sort of like a bread is not an important thing at the table.
Yeah,
as it is maybe in Europe or somewhere.
Yeah, it's really disappointing, I have to say. It really frustrates me. Even to date, you know, it's you know, this bread movement has been big, but restaurants, American restaurants, it's kind of interesting that you know, this movement of once again, I grew up in the Bay Area, so you know, my idea of the food movement of quality food has been, it seems like it's been around quite a while now, but it's fairly modern of how we went from, you know, thinking about American chefs as being, you know, hamburger flippers or something to, and by the way, I love hamburgers, so I like a good hamburger flipper.
I had one last night. With a lousy bun, though.
A lousy bun, isn't that horrible? To, you know, the great cuisine that we're getting to be known for in our country. It's a shame that the bread, you know, that there's still the one part of the restaurant movement that hasn't changed is still that they're cheap, you know, that they want the cheapest, you know, where it seems like bread is an area that a lot of chefs believe that they can save money.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, with this par-bake type of product out there in the market, or even fully baked, frozen, delivered with your buy-right delivery or whoever your distributor is, you know, I have to say that I'm not so against that type of product, because when I'm in many parts of the country that aren't epicenters of culinary extravaganzas, I'm pretty appreciative to have a decent piece of bread wherever the heck it came from, you know.
I've had that experience. I was in Colorado visiting my brother at a ranch he was working at, and it was pretty lousy bread. And fortunately, he went on to a better ranch, and they're making their own bread there, so it's a good thing. It's interesting about the Bread Bakers Guild, because, you know, I notice I've had a lot more bakers now than chefs, I think. Well, I mean, it's even mix, I guess, but seems like bakers want to give information. Is the Bread Bakers Guild like reaching out to other guilds or wannabe guilds around the world to share and make a bigger confederation, maybe?
Well, it's funny, the first part of that, I thought you were going to go off on a tangent, but I'll tell you, the baker's mentality, and I've been really fortunate. I've been a lucky baker, and I really am just a baker. And but because I've noticed, and you know, you talk to Steve, and you talk to Noel, I think, and Jeffrey Hamelman, and so those three people are just, I mean, those are just three bakers that you chose that I happen to know, and I don't know if you chose three other ones. I may know them too, but those three guys were extraordinarily generous to me beginning of my career. You know, Acme let me come into their bakery, and Jeffrey Hamelman was on my team, the baking team, Bread Bakers Guild team in '96, and you know, I was a little, you know, I was at the time I shouldn't have even really been called a baker. I just, you know, had a degree, a culinary school degree, and I had a bakery that had been open a couple of years. But the knowledge I know now compared to then, you know, now I consider myself a baker. Back then I was just lucky enough to be in a country where I could call myself anything I wanted, I guess. So, but the generosity, getting back to the point, the sharing and the generosity is seems to be a common thread throughout the world. Wherever I travel, bakers are willing to share and give. And so to me, there is that brotherhood exists already. And the guild doesn't necessarily, the guild is a small organization. It has, you know, I guess 1,400 or 1,600 members, but we run on a budget of about $100,000 a year, and a significant part of that goes towards educational events and sponsoring the team, the American Baking Team of Current, and then an office staff of 2.5. And the way that things get accomplished in the guild is this enormous amount of volunteer work that we squeeze out of our volunteers, sometimes too hard. So for us to be able to reach out for outside of our mission and try to do much more at the time is, you know, we can barely keep up with what's on our plate already.
I was telling Steve I'm going to Wales this summer to meet some other people to do sort of a camp, Bethesda we call it, because it's in Bethesda, Wales. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And a friend of ours is kind of putting it together through Dan Lepard in England, in conjunction through his forum. And I was telling everybody there, I was like, oh, it's really hard to get to this Camp Bread stuff because, you know, they're usually out in the West Coast or they're always sold out. So I said, I guess it's our turn to do it over here in England. I'll have to travel over there.
Well, the Camp Bread thing is a really interesting phenomenon. It's kind of brings back your question about apprenticeship. The Bread Bakers Guild, Tom McMahon, who started it, got us, rounded up the funds, and created a national baking center that happened to be in Minneapolis. You know, there's debate if Minneapolis was the best place, and there's all kinds of little debates of why it might have worked or why it might have not have worked. But I'll tell you, when you sell out an event in a day for two times in a row, and I'll tell you, the resources it takes to throw this event are enormous. We couldn't possibly do this on, two times a year or whatever, but it's very interesting to see that this sells out in a day, yet we had a really hard time, and we had the best instructors in the country teaching at this school, and we couldn't make that program work. So there's a fine line of, of having enough out there for the people that want to learn and potentially having too much.
Yeah.
And San Francisco Baking Institute is generous enough to give us that facility for that 4 or 5 days. I mean, basically, they shut down. They're out of business while we're there, and they don't charge us. And it's one of the only facilities in our country, unfortunately, where we can have multiple classrooms going at the same time that have the equipment that's needed to teach, you know, hearth bread, artisan-style breads, whatever terminology you're willing to give it.
Right. Yeah, because I went to the French Culinary, and that's where I took baking classes as well as cooking classes. And I tried to get Dan Lepard to do a book signing later on this year, and he was so interested he ended up signing up to the Bread Bakers Guild. And I was like, well, hopefully somebody there can help you out or figure out a way to get you over here, because he's pretty in demand in England and he's pretty popular everywhere else, I think.
Yeah. Well, the French Culinary Institute is a great facility. I actually trained teams there. They've been generous enough, but it's tiny. We couldn't throw anything much larger than a master's class that may have 30 or 40 people in it at most, compared to where we're able to have, you know, we'll have about, including instructors and so forth, we'll have about 300 people on site. So
we're at the Coupe du Monde, and you won that competition. You were in the baguette and specialty breads?
That's correct.
On this sourdough form that I'm on in Australia, we kind of started a little competition. I think I started it, and everybody started following in after and trying to find a way to make the most perfect sourdough baguette. And a lot of people were questioning, but is it really sourdough? So what is a baguette? Is it a sourdough bread, or is it truly a yeasted animal?
Well, I think a baguette's fairly modern. Don't think it's a product that's been around. My memory is full of dust, flour dust, I think. I'm very fascinated by history, but I don't I'm not good at keeping dates in my head. But I don't believe the baguette is all that old.
I think it's in the 20s or something, actually.
Yeah, so the answer in that case to me is that the answer is yes, it's yeasted. If there were baguettes being made, you know, before, you know, in the 1780s or something, to, you know, in that area, of course, then there was no commercial yeast available. So so for me, a classic French baguette is yeasted, commercial yeast. I mean, I tend to be, it was a team effort that won the 96 baguette and specialty category. I happen to be the lucky one that had that under my title, so I tend to be the guy that's talked to about baguettes quite extensively, and certainly that would be my rock-solid answer.
Yeah, and I read that you were saying that it was really difficult to use the French flour because it's a weaker flour than what we have here in the States.
Yes.
So how do you, now, I mean, that you have the experience under your belt, how do you go about coaching people to get ready for that sort of aspect of the bread baking there in France?
Well, that's something that I really enjoy doing, is working with the teams, and I plan on managing the next process too, maybe my last time. One of the things is the job isn't necessarily an easy one, and it takes a lot of time, so it isn't like there's a line of people wanting the job, so I'm kind of lucky that if I want it, I can take it. it isn't so much, you know, there's a Zen, you know, I don't know if that's a good word or not for other people, but I like the word. There's a certain amount of Zen that takes place after you've experienced a lot of baking, and if you baked with the same flour in the same oven with the same mixer for a year on end, and then I threw you into another facility with different flour and a different oven and a different mixer, you're probably going to make pretty crappy bread.
Yeah.
If I throw you into a circumstance during the training of the team, I'm going to give you multiple different types of bags of flour throughout that process, and I'm going to throw you on multiple different mixers and ovens. And so, the having to have French flour to practice isn't of highest priority to me, because, quite frankly, even in the competition, they keep it quite secretive of which bag of French flour you're going to get. So from brand to brand of flour in France, especially in France, because the mills are much smaller and more regional in France, that the flour can vary quite a bit. So it's more important that my bakers or the people that I'm working or training are capable of making almost, you know, non-conscious decisions, you know, that they're understanding the medium to such an extent that they're able to make adjustments without causing them major hurdles. That's what I do, and I incorporate French flour into that process too, but not just French flour. Plus, you know, getting French flour to California isn't necessarily the easiest thing to do.
Sure.
Plus, they pack it still in 50 kilos. So, you know, carrying 50-kilo bag of flour is, I mean, in the United States, we're pretty much in the 25-kilo range, so that's much more manageable than 50, I'll tell you. I can't carry 50 kilos, so.
Yeah, I worked with this baker from Toulouse at a Boulet bakery once, and it was just a totally different mindset after getting out of school. It was totally different the way he worked and the way he try to explain to me the baker's percent in French, and I was like, oh, forget it. It's not going to work. I'll just be your slave for every Friday night and just tell me what to do. So pretty interesting experience there.
Yeah, for sure.
But I ask all my bread guests to talk about rye bread because I love it so much. I was born in Germany and lived there for 3 years. And why do you think there aren't enough rye breads being made or sold, or why do you think Americans haven't adjusted to the flavor yet?
It sure is an interesting thing. I'm lucky enough to travel to Germany. You know, I'm usually there every other year or so, and I have to say I'm pretty fond of the breads over there. I also have to mention, you know, there's a really unfortunate situation going on in a lot of the European countries because of the social system. And the way that they're taxed and so forth, that the decrease in small bakeries is quite dramatic. The small size facilities are just disappearing like crazy. And I went on this tour this last year where we went through bakeries that were quite automated and still knocking out really, really good bread. I don't know. I guess going from Wonder Bread or, you know, that type of bread to a whole grain kind of pudding type of bread, you know, where some of those breads are kind of baked.
Batters.
Yeah, they're like batters and similar to making bread pudding in terms of the way it's baked, you know, in a water bath and sits in a rather cool oven for hours and hours and hours. You know, people would swear to you that they put caramel coloring in some of those, but no, it's the caramelization of that type of bake that's happening. I guess it's just a big jump from one to another. But I'll tell you, people often ask me over the years, why do you make this kind of bread or that kind of bread? And I'm in business, you know. I'm interested in succeeding,
yeah.
And my bread counts. The reason I make the type of breads are because of what people buy, you know. And it isn't just rye, but whole grain versus white bread. And I'm really praying and hoping that that's changing now with all this hype about whole grain, which I would love to get into a little bit. I sell 100 to 1 of my ciabatta type bread to my rye bread, you know.
Huh.
And my rye bread isn't even technically, you know, my percentage of rye flour isn't
not in the high.
Not that high.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, there are a couple specialty bakeries. It's a real small niche, and there's a couple guys or gals in the area here in the Bay Area that are making those brick, you know, fully loaded whole grain rye breads that are fantastic. I haven't been in the culture enough. I mean, I never lived in Germany for months or anything like this. I don't know if I'd be able to eat that bread daily where I can eat my, give the whole grain plug. You know, my whole wheat bread I can have it for toast and have it with my dinner and all that. I don't know if that rye bread is as versatile too. And
peanut butter and jelly or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I guess it's a lost in translation thing if you haven't been there or really eaten the food that's there. But it's interesting because I'm on another forum in Germany, and I love looking at bread sites and picking out pictures and going, wow, I wish I could make that loaf. And fortunately, in some of the German sites, they actually give you the percentages of the ratios of the rye to the wheat or whatever. So I picked some brains of some people at this site, and they're like going, God, can you believe it? You're going to call that German bread? It's got like soy in it, and then it's got apple fiber. It's like, what is that crap? That's not German bread. And I was like, wow, that's kind of harsh. So I actually went and tried a loaf. I skipped the soy, but I put in the apple fiber, and it came out really nice. It was really a fluffy kind of bread in a way. And I said, okay, I'm going to give in to the apple fiber. It works.
Apple fiber, huh?
Yeah, it's just, you know, grated apples. I guess it's just the translations.
Okay. Interesting.
So,
yeah, well, apple in rye breads isn't all that unusual. In fact, fruit and rye goes really well together. It is a loss in translation. And, you know, and the idea of American rye, I mean, I'm really, you know, the platform of my partners isn't just Boudin. We have quite a few bakeries under our belt, and I'm really enjoying getting exposed to all worlds, all different kinds of bakeries. And, you know, when I see people making, you know, quote, Carnegie rye or, you know, Jewish rye or whatever these common terms that they use out there in the marketplace, and they're putting in, you know, 3 or 4% molasses and, you know, a whole lot of sugar and caraway seeds or whatever, I'm just like, well, that sure doesn't look like any rye that I've that I've seen in Germany. So
yeah,
it's too bad.
Well, that's my drum. I just beat it a couple times over people's head, and they go, oh, God, this question again.
Well, it's a good one. I appreciate it. You know, I like the diversity of breads out there, and it's fun to be able to see and make all of them. So,
I actually try to send the recipe to Steve, but I guess my Excel is not working with his Windows platform on his computer, so I posted it on my other blog that I have in the Australian site, so maybe I'll link it to everybody so they'll know how to get that recipe and try it out and tell me if it's actually worth baking.
Okay, well, I'd like to see it. I tend to, I'm a formula guy. I'm really into formula, so I love to see different concepts and ideas, so I'd appreciate that.
Great. How hard is it to get ready for these competitions, and how long is the day to prepare for this? I mean, the day of competition, what do you guys do? Stand on your feet, like... How many hours?
Can I just give a couple-minute plug on the whole concept of the competition?
Of course, sure.
It's, you know, the initial idea is from Christian Vabre, who's the organizer in France, and he started this in something like 92. And it was to actually bring the awareness of good quality bread back to France, was his original concept. And the competition has evolved from, you know, having 9 countries back then in 92 and hand-picking those countries just kind of through contacts and, you know, people like Tom McMahon that happened to be in the right place at the right time and saw this competition and said, this is exactly what we need to do for United States to kind of get their consciousness up on the quality of bread. And I'm involved... I'm going to Mexico in a couple weeks to go catch what they're calling these Louis Le Safra cups, which are regional cups. We're now up to 12 countries in the World Cup. 3 of those countries get a bye, so the first, second, and third place team from the last competition. So they have something like this year, they're having 7 regional competitions all over the world where 54 countries are competing for those 9 spots, which I think is a testament of how Christian's original vision of bringing the consciousness of bread just to France has spread like wildfire over a decade to have 54 countries that are interested in competing for this. And I was just in Canada helping the Canadian team a little bit because, as we talked about in the beginning of this conversation, there's a brotherhood out there and a sharing. And so I'm always interested in helping any team that has any interest in me helping them and the opportunity to meet new people and so forth. And to get to your original answer, the time, or your initial question, the amount of time is, you know, it's a matter of how serious of a country the people that are competing, how much time it takes to get involved, to prepare. And this team in Canada has just spent 6 days in Montreal practicing probably 14 to 16 days or hours on average for just this regional cup, and they're all practicing back at their bakeries a few times a week. The competition itself generally is an hour the night before to do your mise en place and your pre-ferments. Mm-hmm. And then you have an 8-hour session the following day. So, and in this competition next week in Mexico, they have an hour after that 8 hours to clean up, which isn't in the World Cup. You have to be clean by the end of your 8 hours. So... But the actual day of the competition is it's so much like an Olympic event, and even more now that there's 54 countries. I think I just love saying that number because it's so impressive to me that there's these countries from all over the place. I mean, we have Panama and Uruguay, and I'm going to Buenos Aires in Argentina in June to judge one of these competitions, and we have Brazil and Argentina, and there's a couple of these in Asia and then Northern Europe and just all over the world. It's so cool, but it's the work that is similar to preparing for a competition that's physical. You know, you want to peak on that day, and you do a lot of training beforehand, and you almost want it to be a no-brainer, no thinking whatsoever that takes place on the day of the competition. So really the hard work is the preparation before. We'll have our nationals, we'll have our American team picked at Camp Red, and some of these people that are competing for those spots have been practicing since the last, and there's a few people that didn't make it on the last team 2 years ago, and they've been practicing and training since then. And so a lot of people take it pretty seriously and put a lot of effort into it. That's pretty cool.
Who judges these competitions?
In Paris, the World Cup, each country has a judge. So there's the three teammates, and then generally it's the manager of the team that will be the judge. And you judge all the countries but your own. Hmm. And it seems to be really fair to me. I've been lucky enough to judge two of the competitions over in Paris, and it's once again there's a couple countries maybe that cause a little bit of stress in the judging area, but in general we're all there's this brotherhood, and everyone there's kind of a unanimous. It's pretty much always been unanimous who the winner is. It's been a cool process. In the regionals, this is the first time I've been involved in the regionals, and they just started the Louis LaSaffre Regional Cups for the last competition in 2005. And I don't know how many they had or how many countries. I was really not able to focus on that. This year I was invited to the Argentina one to judge. So my understanding is they actually have judges from other countries or areas that are judge the regionals, and that the people that are competing have nothing to do with the judging.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm not sure why or how that took a place. I'm just super thrilled that I was invited.
And do you think the Americans are going to have a run like Lance Armstrong in the Tour de France?
Well, I have a hard thing for me because I'm very, very competitive, and Lance is one of my heroes, and I come from the Bay Area, so Joe Montana, and I like conquering. However, in the World Cup situation in France, it really isn't about the win. It is for individuals, and I've been caught up in it. I can get as disappointed as anybody by not winning and as excited as anybody for winning. But I have to say that it's much healthier for the competition to have different countries win. And so having Japan, for example, win in 2002 was it was great. It was really exciting. You know, we came in second, and I know that I was fine with that. I thought Japan deserved to win, but I know that the guys that worked on the team worked really hard, and were it causes a few months of depression, I think.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So it's pretty hardcore. People, really you put in a lot of effort and work hard, but I'm afraid, to answer your question, that we have that opportunity to continue to be dominant because there's enough passionate people that have been involved in it that want to continue to give, like my time and all the people that I'll bring in to help support the team, past team members and DDA, Rosado will probably help coach a little bit, and all those people will be doing that in kind, in their own time, and that's kind of the special part of it. If all of us were burned out and didn't help a team, and a team just started from scratch without all of our assistance, we would not do well. Mm-hmm. But because we know the competition so well, and we're so focused, much like Lance and his team, you know, part of the reason he did so well is because they knew that competition so well. You know, he wasn't dominating all the other competitions in the world. He was focused on that one. And they knew the strategies. And certainly, you know, it's been my life now for 11 years. And I know that competition very, very well. So until like I say, if there's a break in the momentum where new people come in and aren't necessarily focused or think this is the most important thing, or you know, there's just a new fresh blood situation, then we probably will drop down a little bit in the ranks. But I'll tell you, the last competition, 05, across the board, all nine countries, because of these regional cups that didn't used to exist, countries are coming to the table much more prepared than they used to. So I would be great if we got our butts kicked.
What do you prefer the most, being the competitor or the coach?
Well, I really like competing. The Coupe du Monde, I mean, this is yet another cool thing about it. It isn't fondly looked upon to be, I mean, you're only allowed to compete twice, and if you come in top three, you can't compete again. So if you come in fourth or fifth and you happen to go through the regional process and get to go back to the World Cup, you could compete again. But if you come in top three, you don't get to compete again. So I think that's great because you don't want – this is all about promoting and bringing new people into it and getting youth excited. And in our country, you know, the word youth is maybe a little different because people start careers at all different ages. But in general in the world, people start their careers younger and – I tend to stick to that youth, but I really like both processes. The competing's easier for me. I just get to focus on myself and the two people that I'm working with. When you're managing, you have to deal with a lot of different people.
Sure. And what's your future plan once you've left the coaching or and stuff behind?
Well, I sure am having a great time in this career. I really enjoy the world of bread and the food world, and I don't know. I'm going to. Looks like I'm working on a book. We're in the preliminary stages of settling that, but planning on growing my brand some more. We're moving my facility into a larger facility this year, and my dream is to kind of get to a point where I have. That I'm so busy now that I don't have a lot of free time to give, although I give a lot. I would love it to where I was so free that I could just go around the world and kind of volunteer my services for food and board, you know, room and board, I guess, because I love traveling and I love helping. And I've been lucky enough to be involved in some stuff in India and Africa, and there's a great opportunity for bakeries to actually help orphanages and places like this, you know, set them up with a small bakery and teach the kids skills and also provide food for the actual facility and even have the opportunity of maybe selling a little bit in the region. So I kind of have, you know, wild, grand ideas like that. I really like giving, you know, giving the knowledge I have because it was, you know, everything I've received all my knowledge from people giving to me. So what comes around goes around, you know, the old saying.
Yeah, a friend of mine, the one we're going to visit in Wales, he started a program for criminal offenders to learn how to bake bread, and it was going off pretty well, except the organization that was working with him kind of gave him the shaft, so to speak. So he's going off on his own. He's going to start a little bakery, and he's a little bit later in years. He's not a youth anymore, but he has the youthful spirit of baking bread, so
it's a fantastic medium. I grew up in Oakland, and the school systems in California, public school systems, maybe they're better in some areas, but in Oakland, they certainly were basically just holding cells for the population of children. And I was one of those hyperactive, dyslexic children who didn't fit into the system so well. So I found school extraordinarily frustrating and didn't have a clue that there were these great things you could do that were more physically oriented. And so I love the spending time with the community in all levels. And prison is one that I know some people that work at the bakeries in prison, and I work with children a lot, and certainly the ability to help and give people focus and being part of the community. Baking is just a really special, special opportunity for all kinds of things out there in the world to help with.
Yeah, I had a learning disability as a child, and I wasn't really great in math, so having to learn percentages and stuff was a bit of a challenge, but I think it's kind of helped my math skills over the years. I've actually become a pretty good baker now. So
yeah, and it's as far as I'm concerned, it's a necessity, that part of it, of the math. If you don't know the math, then if you want to be serious about baking, it's the first thing I teach anyone is baker's math.
Yeah,
and it is funny. I don't know. Math is one area that I always kind of enjoyed. So I guess it depends on the mind. But it does keep my brain fresh by crunching numbers all the time. You know, and I find it so interesting. I just love developing formulas. You know, it's just a super.
Well, I'm just starting to learn how to do that because Jeffrey Hamelman was teaching me a class up in Vermont, and I was trying to figure out how to do all this stuff. And, you know, I learned it in school, but you get kind of lazy when you're not doing it every day like most bakers. And he said, oh, I have troubles with it too. I mean, he goes, my wife told me just sit down and look at the paper and figure it out. So I have to do that myself. And,
yeah, yeah.
And I finally got a recipe that I kind of said, hey, I kind of developed this out of just, you know, a couple numbers that I picked together and said, okay, I can formulate this.
Well, that's the freedom of baker's math. It gives you, this is my passion, is teaching people the ability. I'm not one to hand somebody a formula as part of the class, you know, go make this. I'm one to show you how to manipulate a formula into being your own thing, you know, which it's super cool. It's super fun.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to take too much more of your time, and I know you're probably busy, but I want to thank you.
And I really appreciate it.
Hopefully you get to hear this interview as well.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying your interviews. I've been having fun. I listened to Jeff's and Steve's. Natalie said I should do that, the woman that helps me out here, and so I did, and I really enjoyed both of those interviews. So
yeah, you should hear my friend in Australia. He's got an association down there, Graham Pritchard. He's a pretty funny guy.
I think I've met Graham. I think he's come to my bakery.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He has a book out?
No, he doesn't, no.
Oh, okay.
No, but he's a pretty funny guy, and he's trying to get sort of a bread baker's guild going down there in Australia.
Well, it's interesting. We have some Australian members, and there's one guy that said, are you on the chat group of the Bread Baker's Guild?
You know, I do once in a while, but I've got so many different forums.
Yeah, you sound
can't keep track of everything.
Yeah, well, that they have a forum. You know, we have a group, a Yahoo group that's set up, and there's one guy who's on there all the time, who's from Australia, and he was really complaining about giving the organizations in that part of the world a really rough time.
Yeah, Graham actually wrote a little article on his site about that recently, and about the cup that they're starting, and so it's a bit of a political thing, but it's good. It's, you know, keeps the big companies in line and stuff, I guess. And
yeah, yeah, that's right.
Trying to teach them a lesson about who the artisans are, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, well, I certainly believe that the artisans have given the big companies fuel for fire for business opportunities.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, they're jumping all over it, and that was part of the debate in the chat group the other day, was how Jack in the Box has you know, the ciabatta rolls, and
oh no,
and actually, you know, it's because I'm so fascinated, and I am working at so many different levels of bakeries, I'm out there looking at consumer goods all the time, and the ciabatta is not a bad product. that's on this Jack in the Box. And in fact, you know, I hate to say it, but it's better than a lot of small bakeries that are trying to make ciabatta. So, so there's a weird, you know, there's kind of a weird thing there. That's why I tend to defend all size bakeries, because to me, it's the master baker behind whatever methodology is being used there. Is, you know, it's the methodology. I can make really good bread on any size bakery, you know, because I know how to manipulate the medium in a way that I still get the fermentation I want and the flavors and get the whole structure I'm looking for. A Jack in the Box product, I don't think is such a bad thing, because it's educating the consumer. I'd much rather, like the hamburger you had last night, if you had it on the Jack in the Box ciabatta roll, I bet you would have said, this is great bread.
Or if I made the roll myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Either or.
Yeah.
Did you make the roll yourself?
No. It was, the restaurant bought it outside. Although I do make a little mini hamburger rolls for my job at work, for Mini Hamburger. So.
What is your job at work?
I'm a chef at a private club in Manhattan.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, you live in a great place of the world, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I just wish there were more, like, local bakeries. That's also another one of my gripes, that, you know, we're not like in Paris with the little boulangerie every corner, you know?
Yeah, it's just a cultural thing, you know, and plus your real estate.
Yeah, forget it.
But you do have Amy.
Yeah, we do, and I work there with her, too, and she's a really wonderful lady.
Oh, she's one of my favorites. I would, if she didn't get married to whoever she did, I wanted her.
There you go.
I love Amy. Yeah, she's a beautiful woman.
Yeah.
And she's a super successful business lady. That's I guess she has 3 locations now, or 4?
Yeah, and actually it might be, it's 3, but I think she's going on to something else, but we'll see, I guess.
Yeah, and what's the name of the Chelsea Market? That's fairly
Chelsea Market. Yeah,
that sure is a fun location.
Oh yeah, I've shaped some breads there and bagged some loaves, and I'm telling you, my back's never felt so much pain in my life.
Yeah, well, that's the home baker. Welcome to the
real world.
The real world.
Yeah,
I heard you're
just being an old chef. You know, I'm getting old, too salty or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is hard work, but somebody's got to do it, right?
Exactly.
Okay, my friend.
Okay, thanks a lot, Craig.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.